Welcome to the Number 10 Podcast. Episode 7, The Revolutionary Settlement. We left off with England in a strange situation. James II, England's king, had escaped to France and William had arrived in London. Before he arrived, and in the absence of James, who was in the middle of his first escaped attempt, there had been riots in London, where every single Catholic church in London was attacked, and some completely demolished. City governors and nobility were forced to become self-appointed policemen, and struggled to bring the mobs under control. When William entered the city, there were cheers and the rioting subsided. This may have also been because James was also being brought back to the city after being caught trying to escape. William even had to stop his procession into London to allow the king to go past in order to avoid a confrontation. William ordered James to get out of the city in 10 hours, which he did with the assistance of a bunch of Dutch troops. It is a contentious point whether he escaped the troops in order to flee France or William instructed his soldiers to get him gone. With James gone, there was a real problem now for England. The king had left the country and now there was a foreign invader in the capital. Those in Parliament were torn as to what to do next. Some wanted to secure parliamentary rule instead of a monarchical dictatorship, and others simply wanted to secure Protestant succession. The Declaration of Reasons was released in September 1688 by William, stating that it was James's evil counsellors who gave him bad advice. Now this may sound a bit indirect, but remember, seditious libel laws meant you could not attack the monarch directly. William had brought numerous printing presses with him, and 60,000 copies of this address were distributed across the land. William called a meeting of MPs in January 1689. Now, William and Mary were smart. He didn't invite the last lot of members of Parliament to sit, but called all the MPs who sat in Parliament under Charles II. This would make sure that James's allies were kept out, and hopefully one that would be more on board with William and Mary taking power. The main aim of the Parliament was to determine whether James had abdicated and how William and Mary would ascend to the throne. I think by accepting the summons to attend Parliament, they already had the authority to take the crown, as only a monarch can announce and begin a parliamentary session. As we mentioned in the question and answer episode, William refused to be regent to Mary, who was the English link to the line of succession. As Lord Halifax said, as nobody knew what to do with him, nobody knew what to do without him. So what did Parliament think? A heavy Whig government was elected in the swiftly run elections of January 1689, with 319 Whigs and 232 Tories gaining seats. To give you an idea of the swing of this election, the Whigs had had 57 seats in 1685 and the Tories had 468. What is interesting is despite the changes in seats, it looked like both sides really wanted to work towards a compromise. In the Lords, there wasn't much support for the new monarchy. A few, led by the group of bishops, including Archbishop Sancroft, did not want to see the rule of law messed with. They had greatly opposed James's religious changes as breaches of law, and couldn't now stand up and say that this was allowed. It would be hypocritical. A larger group of lords favoured a regency. The idea was for William and Mary to rule as regents, which was essentially a role held by someone who would administer the crown whilst the monarch was underage, absent or incapacitated. After James II died, they would become fully fledged monarchs. There's a long history for regents being the right solution. For example, Henry VIII had three regents throughout his reign. Lady Margaret Beaufort looked after the crown while Henry VIII was a minor, and Catherine of Aragon and Catherine Parr both looked after the crown for periods where Henry was abroad in France. We see this again under Henry's son, Edward, and we're about to see it at the end of the next monarch that we're covering, whilst the new monarch is on his way from Hanover. Though if you just brought 10 or 20,000 troops across from the continent, you weren't coming over for second prize. William, Mary and Anne, who if you remember had sided with the Dutch couple over her father James II, had all shown their public disapproval of the solution. It did go to a vote, however, but it failed by 3 votes. The Whigs in the House of Commons put forward the idea that James had broken his social contract between himself and the people. This would soon be encapsulated in John Locke's 2 treatises on civil government. It was the revolutionary idea that thought that the king had duties to his people and that those were more important than the idea that his inalienable rights came from God. If the king didn't fulfil his side of the contract, he should be removed from the throne. I mean, isn't this what happened to Charles I when he was executed? Some wanted to discuss the idea that James had abdicated by leaving, but it soon came clear through letters that James wrote to England that he was happy to return as long as Parliament could guarantee his safety. If James had abdicated, then there was a constitutional crisis, as the throne is technically never empty. The role passes automatically from holder to heir, as the famous adage goes, "The king is dead, long live the king." Some argued that if Parliament chose who filled the role, then we were merely an elected monarchy, similar to how William became stadtholder of the Netherlands. But hey, this is England, and we don't do it like that. We like our monarchy old school. When the Commons sent their recommendations to the House of Lords, they denied they were attempting to subvert the political system, and that they were just dealing with a difficult situation in front of them. Sir George Treby, a lawyer at the time, said, "We have found the crown vacant. We found it so. We did not make it so." The Lords debated the matter for a solid 24 hours. They changed the wording of the bill that James had deserted the throne and instead said that he had simply abdicated, as well as removing any mention of a vacant throne. The Commons pressured the Lords to accept the original wording for 4 full days. And it even got so bad that William said that he'd return to Holland rather than accept a regency. 7 days after the anniversary of the execution of Charles I, and 9 days since the initial idea went to the upper house, the Lords agreed to the Commons' resolution, and William and Mary became King and Queen of England. Happy ending? All sorted? Brilliant. Well, no. When has British history ever been that easy? The end agreement was so vague, it allowed each different party and sect of Parliament to interpret it as they wanted, and draw a victory from it. Whilst all this was going on, politicians were also drawing something else up. Now, we have gone from the absolutist monarchy of the Tudors and are currently on the cusp of a constitutional monarchy and the rule of Parliament. Parliament used the chaos of the monarch change to consolidate its power. Under James, it looked as if the political situation was heading swiftly towards the absolutist monarchy that France was under, and now it was about to massively reverse. Now, this next bit is important. James had alienated both the Tory elite and the Protestant exclusionists that made up the Whig power. He had caused a revolution that was partly fueled by the common man, but also the landed gentry and elite. For this reason, the settlement we're about to discuss encompasses all of their concerns and desires, wide-ranging and vast as they were. William and Mary were about to cede their control over taxation, the military, foreign policy, and their ability to call Parliament. Part of this would become known as the Declaration of Rights, and once passed, the Bill of Rights, and is the first piece of legislation we're going to discuss today in the Revolutionary Settlement. My idea with this episode is not to give you a blow-by-blow feature of William and Mary's reign, but to talk through the legislation that will bind them to Parliament as monarchs, and I'll try to squeeze in as many events in and around this whilst we talk about what was happening in Westminster with legislation. By February, the Convention Parliament, which William had called up in Oxford, had drawn up a Declaration of Rights. This would later become known as the Bill of Rights. It was, as I said, a compromise between Whigs and Tories. The Whigs wanted a constitutional monarchy, whilst the Tories wanted, by any count, an absolutist monarchy. What's interesting about this is that it was not just because of the Whig majority that the monarch was limited, but for one of the few times in British history, those in the middle ground on both sides created the compromise and dominated the course of the Parliament, leading to this document. The Declaration laid out the sins of James II, including prorogation of Parliament, illegal prosecutions, popery, and many other naughty things.
What's wrong with popery? It just smells nice.
No, not that kind of popery. The doctrines of the Catholic Church. Absolutist monarchy. More importantly, the document laid out the rights of the citizen and what the monarchy could no longer get away with. Here are the key points. 1. Only Parliament could make and suspend laws of the country. The monarchy had no power to execute or dispense laws. 2. No Catholic institutions were to be established or built. 3. The Crown cannot levy taxes without the consent of Parliament. 4. British citizens have the right to petition the King without fear of punishment, such as prosecution. 5. There would be no standing armies in times of peace. This may sound strange today, but back in these times, no country could afford to feed, water, and pay a standing army unless they were going to be fighting in an ongoing war. Parliament could raise an army in times of peace, but the monarch could not. Parliament had to pass each year a Mutiny Act, as the limitation was limited to only 1 year. This continued until 1879. The monarch in practice still governed military forces overseas in the colonies, as the Act only covered military forces in England. 6. All Protestants have the right to bear arms for defence. Yes, we had that one too. However, it mentions that the arms you're allowed is subject to the laws of the country, which is why you don't have the right to arm yourself in the same way as our friends do across the pond. 7. Parliament must be freely elected. Fair elections, however, aren't to be for another 100 years. 8. Members of Parliament have the right to free speech without prosecution and can speak with impunity. This still stands today. Anything that a Member of Parliament says in the Commons, they cannot be prosecuted for. We've seen in past Members of Parliament lifting super injunctions laid out by the court because they cannot be sued or prosecuted for lifting those which the average or the normal citizen could be if they did. 9. Bail fees, fines and unusual punishments are banned. 10. All trials should now have juries, and those accused of high treason will be tried by a jury of landowners. 11. No one can seize property or levy a fine on someone who has not been convicted. 12. Parliament must meet frequently. Quite a lot of changes there, you're probably thinking, and you're absolutely right. Think about what we started in this podcast in the 1500s and where we are now. On April 11, 1689, William and Mary were crowned King and Queen of England. Before they did so, at the ceremony, they read aloud the Declaration of Rights. Interestingly, Bishop Henry Compton, one of the Immortal Seven, who wrote the letter to William, performed the coronation. William Sancroft, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, refused to swear an oath to William and Mary and was absent from the coronation, which was why Compton stood in. 8 bishops and 400 clergy took this stance as well and became known as the non-jurors. Sancroft found himself retired soon after this. It is an interesting fact that all of the Immortal Seven did pretty well out of their invitation to William. Many received titles and saw a return to power. I mean, that was what they were after all, wasn't it? John Churchill, who was once a favourite of James II, now found himself with the title of the Earl of Marlborough, although he also was appointed the Duke of Marlborough in 1702 when Anne came to the throne. At their coronation, William and Mary swore to uphold the new laws and customs, including the Declaration of Rights. April 11, 1689 ended the absolutist monarchy in Great Britain. The Declaration of Rights gained royal assent in December 1689 and is now known as the Bill of Rights, and is still talked about by MPs in Parliament today. This was the first piece of legislation that makes up the Revolutionary Settlement. It was a great compromise to get those people to accept the change of monarchy. It had to happen for William and Mary to be accepted. What was brilliant about it was everyone could see something in it that they could agree with and accept it. Shortly after their coronation, the monarchical duo gave royal assent to the Toleration Act that gave freedom of worship to those Protestants who had moved away from the Church of England, including Baptists, Presbyterians, and Congregationalists. However, as had been enshrined in the Declaration of Rights, Catholics were not included in this. Neither were non-Trinitarians and atheists, but we're talking about a tiny number of those in this period of time. Over 2,500 chapels were licensed over the next 20 years. This law largely influenced by the work of top philosopher John Locke, who had laid out essentially the same belief, including the Catholic exclusion, in his letter concerning toleration written in 1685 and published in 1689. The Bill of Rights also settled the question on succession of the crown. it was agreed that if either William or Mary died, the other would continue to be monarch until they also died. After this, Anne would become queen. The Oxford Convention that was turned into a parliament after the coronation didn't last long. William wanted to rule with support from both parties, but the Whigs weren't interested. They wanted to see some Tories imprisoned for their open support of James II and popery. Again, Catholic doctrine. Not fragrant plant materials, as Mrs. Number 10 thought. William tried to settle this by bringing in a bill indemnifying the Tories for their past actions, but with a Whig majority, that wasn't going to get passed. The Whigs were beginning to really annoy William. When he proposed sending an army of European mercenaries and recruits to Ireland to finish off James II and his supporters, they rejected it, worried about his health in the wet and windy weather of Ireland, as well as being uncomfortable with the idea of foreign troops on British soil. William, sick of getting nowhere, dissolved Parliament. Now, unlike past kings doing this, he immediately called new elections. The 1690 elections were fiercely fought with mass pamphlet, sermons and speeches. The Tories won the day and William began to get his policy moving, starting with an act of grace to forgive the Tories for their past indiscretions, which only required a brief reading in the House of Lords to become law. I wanted to mention a podcast app that we've been getting quite a few of our listeners through recently called Podcoin. It essentially pays you to listen to podcasts, paying you with Amazon or Starbucks gift vouchers. What's great as well is that you can also donate your points to charitable causes such as clean water, HIV treatments, and helping those who are homeless. It's a free app and it's really easy to use. So go get Podcoin app on Apple or Android today. And use the invite code the number 10 podcast. You'll get 300 podcoins just for signing up if you use our code. That's 300 podcoins just for signing up if you use the code the number 10 podcast. Anyway, let's get back to it. Now, to talk about Scotland and Ireland. The revolution was complex for these parts of the British Isles. In Scotland, James still had a huge amount of support from the Stuart strongholds in the Highlands and the North East, and this remained so for the majority of the 1700s. These supporters were known in both Scotland and Ireland as the Jacobites, from the Latin for James being Jacobus. The Jacobites believed that the king had divine rights and was put in place by God, and that James had been removed from the throne illegally. In Ireland, the revolution was bloody. James landed in Ireland in 1689 from France with a garrison of French troops. The Parliament in Dublin, known as the Patriot Parliament, declared him the lawful king, where James went on to expand Catholic economic and political rights in Ireland. William sailed from Cheshire in 1690 with 16,000 troops on 280 troop transport ships to Ireland. William's top general, the Duke of Schomberg, was already in Ireland, establishing their position in Dundalk with an army of 20,000 men, largely through defensive manoeuvres and not wanting to be drawn into an open battle without being at full strength. The key battle was held across the River Boyne, near the hamlet of Oldfield, north of Drogheda, with William's forces on one side and James's on the other. Artillery was key in this battle, with two sets of cannons firing at each other across the body of water. William, the day before the battle, was struck by a cannonball that ricocheted off the Boyne riverbank and hit him in the shoulder. He was left relatively unscathed, but it is interesting to think what would have happened if it had indeed killed him. The night before the battle, William's forces donned green bows on their caps, and James's troops wore white strips of papers in their caps so they could tell each other apart in the midst of battle. At dawn, on the 1st of July, Schomberg's son, Meinhard, was at the north of the river in perfect position to outflank the Jacobite army, and led 8,000 troops around the left flank of James's forces. He met a group of around 500 dragoons on James's side near a ford at Rough Grange, which they defeated and continued to threaten the flank. James then sent a vast majority of his top troops, who were predominantly French, to counter the diversion, although due to impassable terrain, they spent the entirety of the battle firing artillery at each other as they couldn't reach each other and in turn sat most of the battle out. The main battle began at 8 a.m. at the main crossing near Oldbridge, where William sent his elite Dutch Blue Guards, led by the Duke of Schomberg and George Walker, across the river, forcing back the Jacobite foot troops. George Walker was a priest who had been made joint governor of Londonderry during the first big event of the Williamite War in Ireland, where James attempted to starve out Londonderry into capitulation, but failed. Walker, Schomberg and the troops became pinned down by James II's son and his cavalry unit. Despite the Dutch Blue Guards fighting with professional volley shots known as fire by rank, where the first line will fire, then kneel, then the second line will fire, then kneel, and so on for four or five lines, the forces across the river became scattered. Now, the Dutch Blue Guards tried their best to cover the retreat. Schomberg was slashed twice in the head by Jacobite sabres and shot in the neck, killing him instantly. George Walker also died attempting to get back across. Schomberg had had a distinguished 56-year-long military career, fighting for Sweden, France, Portugal, and of course the Netherlands. Ironically, Schomberg had protested against crossing the river before the battle. However, William overruled him, and he, as the good officer, complied. As the battle went on, William sent his cavalry across the river, where they were badly injured, but supported by Huguenot troops, they had time to regroup and attack the Jacobite troops. The Jacobites began to retreat, and despite William's best efforts, they were unable to pursue the main body of the army, held off by a superbly orchestrated rearguard defensive manoeuvre. The Jacobites had lost. Many deserted, and for the second time in a short period of history, James found himself without an army. Not because it was completely disbanded, there were around 1,500 dead in an army of around 25,000. It was because James lost his nerve and fled to France after the defeat at the Battle of Boyne. William was still hesitant to kill James because, you know, his wife was James's daughter and all that. James became known as Seamus Achacha in Irish Gaelic, which translates to James the Shit, by the Irish troops who continued to fight until 1691 and the Treaty of Limerick ended the conflict. After the battle, William entered Dublin 2 days later and issued the Declaration of Finglas that offered amnesty to the Jacobite rank and file, but not to the officers. 1,000 troops joined William's army, and 2,000 decided to head home. By not including the officers, it encouraged fighting for another year, but as I said, it was all over by October 1691. The Jacobites, led by Patrick Sarsfield, boarded transport bound for France after the treaty in what is known as the Flight of the Wild Geese, which was usually a term used for an Irishman who went abroad to fight in European wars. Sarsfield would be killed 2 years later in Belgium, fighting for the French in the Nine Years' War. James had been seen off, and not only this, but it quelled talks of uprisings in Scotland amongst Highlanders, who were already badly damaged from the failed Jacobite uprising in Edinburgh and the Battle of Killiecrankie, where their leader, Bonnie Dundee, was killed. Long forgotten about by many English people, the Battle of the Boyne is still a controversial topic in Ireland. Every year on the 12th of July, the Orangemen of Ulster and other parts of Northern Ireland march through the streets in orange sashes, bowler hats, accompanied by drums and whistles. This is often met by protesters and can be quite violent. To the Orangemen, this is about their identity as being British, and they celebrate William's win as the day they remained as an English dominion. This is of course offensive to those who want to see reunification between the North and the South, but it's interesting that this is only remembered in one part of the UK. The next important piece of legislation of the Revolutionary Settlement was the Triennial Act of 1694, otherwise known as the Meeting of Parliament Act. Now, if you're a history buff of this period, you'll say, hey, we've already had two of those, and you'd be absolutely right. 1641 saw the first Triennial Act during the English Long Parliament under King Charles I that required Parliament to meet for at least 50 days every 3 years. This was a concession made by Charles after ruling for 11 years without Parliament from 1629 to 1640. Charles II brought in the second Triennial Act of 1664, repealing the 1641 version that forced Parliament to meet every 3 years. There was no instrument to enforce this, so Charles ruled for the rest of his reign without it. Now, 53 years after the first one, the 1694 Triennial Act made sure Parliament met annually, and that general elections happened every 3 years. This led to something called the Rage of Party. With regular elections, it caused a huge amount of animosity in Parliament between MPs and led to massive political instability. Fierce elections and bribery were commonplace as Tories and Whigs went against each other, competing for a majority in the House of Commons. This is the first time we really see this. In the 1688 election, Sir Henry Hobart, who had been the de facto leader of the Norfolk Whigs, lost his seat to a Tory candidate, despite spending a lot of money securing it. Now, to show how sneaky you could be in elections, he had also stood and paid for a seat in St Ives, which he had connections to through his wife. He lost that one as well. Incredibly upset, he accused a Tory squire in Norfolk of causing the defeat and challenged him to a duel. Hobart was killed in the duel, which marks the last death by duel in Norfolk on record. Crazy stuff. From 1688 to 1715, there were 11 parliaments, meaning that the mood of Parliament regularly shifted as the MPs came and went. To give you some perspective, in the last 27 years, we have had 7 parliaments or elections compared to the 11 that they have had. And you could probably agree with me that that's been pretty chaotic with 7. So imagine what 11 would have been like. Over the Rage of Party period, we see the formation of party leadership, especially that of the Whig Junto, which was the name given to the leadership of the party under Lords Somers, Montague and Orford. The Earl of Orford was otherwise known as Edward Russell, who had been one of the Immortal 7, so another one who has done pretty well out of the invitation of William. William curried favour with both Whig and Tory ministers across the period, which he did alone from the end of 1694 when Mary died. William then ruled alone for the next 8 years. The last piece of legislation that made up the Revolutionary Settlement was the Act of Settlement in 1701. Now, this came up because William and Mary hadn't produced any children, or heirs as they were more commonly known, and nor had Princess Anne. This would mean that the line of succession would fall to Catholic James Francis Edward Stuart, the son of James II, also known as the Old Pretender. Under the Act, anyone who was a Catholic or married one was disqualified from being King or Queen of England. The Old Pretender, who was a Catholic and had also married one, was no longer in the line of succession. Alongside this Act was another one known as the Security of Succession Act in 1701. That made every office holder swear an oath of abjuration, abandoning support for the Old Pretender. We'll be speaking more about the Old Pretender next episode. It also made it treasonable to compass or imagine the death of Princess Anne. However, this clause never actually came into force, as Anne became queen before the Act came into effect, and she was protected from this with legislation covering the monarchy. I'm also going to tell you something about the Act of Settlement that is the kind of thing that gets me very excited. It's about the rule of law and democratic process. The Act of Settlement is still a live, important part of our unwritten constitution today in the UK, and also in the Commonwealth countries. No country in the Commonwealth can vote to change or amend this Act independently because of the shared crown across the Commonwealth. To change this Act, all Commonwealth countries must agree on it before it goes ahead. In the 318 years that it has been law, it has only been changed once, in 2015, where the disqualification for marrying a Roman Catholic was removed. The monarch, however, must still be Protestant. They are, after all, the head of the Church of England. Also very interestingly, this period is also where the front bench in Parliament became an official thing. A lot of people ask, where did the monarchy become a rubber stamp? And it happened here. The Treasury Bench, which was the front bench on the government side of the House of Commons, forced the monarch to ask for money, and if they refused to approve legislation, then guess what? No money for the sovereign. This limited the power that a king or queen had, stopping the problems of the previous century from the likes of James II and Charles I, where they had just shut Parliament down when they didn't get their own way. These financial managers and ministers of the sovereign were in attendance so often that their seats were reserved and would sit in the front row of the government side of the House of Commons with the opposition sitting in waiting. William and Mary's reign was incredibly interesting and filled with big events such as the 9-year war that England inherited when William and Mary came to the throne, ending in 1697. The 9-Year War was probably the first global war ever. It involved the Holy Roman Empire, the Dutch, the English, and Savoy against the French. The Williamite War in Ireland encompassed this, as the troops were basically funded by Louis XIV. The peace with France wouldn't last long, when the War of Spanish Succession pitted him against Louis XIV again, with quite a few European countries involved. It started because Charles II of Spain died without producing an heir. This was probably due to centuries of inbreeding and marrying one's cousin, and when Charles II died, the Spanish Habsburg line ceased to exist. Now, the Habsburgs had once been the most powerful family of royals across Europe, all the way back to the likes of the medieval duchies of Swabia in modern-day Germany, but were slowly going extinct and ended royal rule in 1919 in Austria after the abolition of the monarchy after World War I. Still, 1,000 years of royalty isn't too bad. When Charles II died without a successor, the throne looked like it was going to pass to Louis XIV of France, who was already massively powerful. So Protestant Europe ganged up on France and went to war. This would go on until 1714, so we'll talk about this a little bit more under our next monarch. I like to think of the War of Spanish Succession like a rehearsal for the Napoleonic Wars that will happen in about 100 years. The Bank of England, national debt, and the first lottery scheme were also established during their reign. But I'll go into a lot more detail on that when we get to Robert Walpole and the South Sea Bubble, probably the episode idea that started this podcast. But as I said, we're not here to look at the monarchs, we're here to look at the prime ministers, so I hope you enjoyed the whistle stop tour. William died after falling from his horse, Sorrel, and then catching pneumonia. The horse had tripped into a mole's burrow, catapulting William off. Jacobites in Scotland and Ireland at the time toasted the little gentleman in the black velvet waistcoat, referring to the mole. He was buried next to Mary in Westminster Abbey, London. Anne, his sister-in-law, assumed the throne. The king is dead. Long live the queen. The territories in the Dutch Republic that he was stadtholder of suspended the office after his death, leading to the second stadtholderless period, which would see a vacant head of state until 1647, where William IV would become stadtholder of the Dutch Republic. William was the last male heir of a line of Dutch stadtholders which went back 500 years and ended England's flirtation with Dutch monarchs. We are back to a Scottish Stuart, however, we'll be going back to the continent to find a new royal line in only a few years. Thank you very much for listening, and as always, please do tell your friends, family, your GP, your priest about this podcast, as we want to spread the word as far as the British Empire once reached and even further than that. The questions have already become flying in for the next Q&A episode, so thank you for that. And if you've got a spare moment, please submit a rating as well on Apple iTunes. These are really important for other people finding our podcast, and I'll give you a shout out on the air if you're kind enough to head to the podcast section on iTunes and write something nice about us. To let you know, we actually entered the new and noteworthy section for history and government sections on the podcast app for iTunes. So thank you all for your support. Someone is obviously paying attention at iTunes HQ. Now, we're also coming to the end of our current season. I always plan to take a break around October, as I'll be heading on honeymoon with Mrs. Number 10, so want some time to relax and get stocked back up on scripts that I've run at a bit of a deficit over the last few months. So we're going to be releasing a few more chat episodes, a bonus episode on a side character, and a little side note episode on the Whigs and Tories in a bit more detail as we run towards our first Prime Minister, as well as the state of elections at this time. When we return from our break, we're going to continue the storyline in the new series, where we stop talking about England and start talking about the United Kingdom.